May it please the court, I'm Mark Kaplan. I represent Rodney Schultz, the plaintiff and appellant. At council table is my co-counsel, Julia Purchase, formerly of my firm. And I've asked her, she's relented, to let me speak before the panel. There are a number of ways, I think, to approach this case. I am happy to approach it any way that helps the court. It seems to me that the best start would be the question as to whether the initial complaint was adequate to establish a claim of negligence for failing to call the victim, Mr. Castillo, to testify at the criminal trial. As the court is aware, my client was one of two prison guards who was convicted of assault and conspiracy to assault Mr. Castillo. Mr. Castillo subsequently testified in front of Judge Daniel in a motion for new trial that Mr. Schultz was not the one that beat him and that he was friendly to Mr. Castillo. The issue that was raised on the initial complaint was a claim of negligence for not calling him. And it's our belief that that complaint, it should be broadly construed, and that would include any other reasonably inferred factual allegation, so to speak, that is part of a negligence claim. The trial judge felt that that claim was very narrowly to be considered as only putting Mr. Castillo on the stand. And then he contrasted that with what the Tenth Circuit said in their more recent opinion dealing with the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That decision by the Tenth Circuit, I must admit, could have put an end to this case. It's my belief that it didn't, and I'm hoping it's your determination that it didn't, precisely because the Tenth Circuit gave a very specific ruling. And what they said is that Mr. Castillo's testimony, the failure to call him, was not prejudicial because he was testifying that he was beaten. And the defense that was presented at that trial was there was no beating. So how would you help your client if, in fact, you're presenting contrary evidence to your defense? The case that is presented here, this civil case, is quite different in that we are saying they should have put the witness on the stand that he was beaten, but not by Mr. Schultz, and that Mr. Schultz would have testified, and others would have testified, that he was not involved in any beating, and that the defense should have been that other people beat Mr. Castillo, as Mr. Castillo says. There would not have been that inconsistency. And it's my request that we be entitled to go to a jury and have the jury hear that evidence, that Mr. Castillo was beaten, but not by Mr. Schultz.
Wasn't the criminal case based in part on a conspiracy?
Yes, sir. Yes.
So he could still be guilty as a conspirator if he did not, in fact, beat anybody.
That is clearly one outcome that could happen. The jury could decide that he was involved in the conspiracy. Because Mr. Schultz admits, as does Mr. Castillo, I believe, but certainly Mr. Schultz admits that he was involved in taking Mr. Castillo from his cell to a holding cell. Mr. Castillo was then, based on other evidence, taken from the holding cell to another location to be beaten. So the jury could find that Mr. Schultz knew about this.
Was Mr. Schultz involved in the second move?
No. So clearly a reasonable jury could find Mr. Schultz was in on some conspiracy. My point is, in my briefs and now, is that a jury could also reasonably find that Mr. Schultz was not involved in the conspiracy because he didn't beat up or assault Mr. Castillo. When the jury is faced with testimony that my client was involved in the assault and there's no victim to say otherwise, then it naturally follows that he would be considered involved in a conspiracy. The converse is also true. If the victim says, he didn't beat me, he was nice to me, the jury could then conclude he wasn't involved in a conspiracy either. Now, if you allow the other evidence to come in a trial, such as Mr. Freeman, who's another prison guard, such as the victim's cellmate, then you're going to have additional evidence that there was no conspiracy involving Mr. Schultz, because there were grounds to take Mr. Castillo out of his cell and put him in a holding cell because he was acting out. That would be further evidence that he had justified reason to have any involvement in this incident with Mr. Castillo.
It seems like you're leaving out one element here. Both Judge Daniel and I think the 10th Circuit found or concluded that at the criminal trial, there was a joint defense agreement. And because of the joint defense agreement, there was no way to put even if they knew about Mr. Castillo, they couldn't put him on as a witness. It would have been inconsistent with the defense. It would have been inconsistent with his own testimony that he was among the guards who moved Castillo, and that Castillo's testimony was ambiguous at best. I forget the word they used, something more pejorative than that. So that it would not have made any difference to the jury, even if all this had been put on.
Well,
isn't that a finding or a conclusion by both the 10th Circuit and Judge Daniel that has preclusive effect, if you just stick with the original complaint?
I would say no. And the reason I say no is that what Judge Daniel and the 10th Circuit said is very consistent with what you just said, that because you had this joint defense agreement and alleged that there was no beating, like all the other defendants did, then you sort of live by the sword, die by the sword, you can't come in with contrary evidence. It's not believable. It's not credible. It's however you want to pronounce it.
It's not going to make a difference in the result of the jury's verdict.
Right. But what we're saying in this case is, so in other words, what they were dealing with is, this is the case that was presented. There's no beating. You have a joint defense agreement. Everybody says there's no beating. That's the case we're looking at. So Judge Daniel looked at, what the 10th Circuit looked at, and they're saying, well, wait a minute. It wouldn't have made a difference if you brought in this contrary evidence. In this case, what we're saying is they should have done this in a non-negligent fashion, and that includes putting on the victim who says he was not beaten by this person. That includes taking a position that we don't care what the other defendants would have done. Our expert would testify that to be competent, they should have gone into court and separated from the joint defense and presented this evidence, which wouldn't have been contrary.
And so you alleged in your proposed amended complaint.
Which is the second part of your question. So aren't I precluded because of the first complaint? And I think the second complaint, deals with that in particular. So the first complaint is too narrow a construction to say that our complaint that says two things. One is that they should have put on Castillo to testify, and that had he testified, that he would not have been convicted of the charges. That, to read it so narrowly, is to also kind of read in and keep the same defense, and keep the defense agreement in check, and still argue that no beating occurred. But that's not what I said in the complaint. That would really narrowly confine what I said in the complaint. Instead, what I said is you should put him on the stand, he would have been acquitted. Now, they had a defense in their motion to dismiss early in this case, 2005, 2006, where they said, well, there are reasons we didn't put him on the stand. We had a joint defense agreement. It would have been inconsistent. So they understood that my initial complaint raised those issues, that it dealt with the overall representation of this person in this criminal case. They understood that my complaint encompassed the whole concept of this joint defense agreement and whether they should have taken that position or not. What I'm trying to do is get to a jury where they can have their experts say that's reasonably competent to take that position. I can have my experts say it's reasonably not competent, and then the jury can decide what should happen.
Had you alleged what you later alleged in your proposed amended complaint, that's probably what would have happened. But it wasn't alleged in the first complaint, and the judge concluded that the language of the first complaint, which is pretty specific, just does not encompass every single possible act of negligence that a lawyer might have committed during the case, that has to be spelled out. Isn't that what the judge was saying here?
That's what they're just saying. That's why I think the judge abused discretion, because the standard is notice pleading. If I say that they were negligent in the representation, I don't have to go into how or the specifics or and because of the joint defense agreement or whatever. I don't have to do that in notice pleading. And what's, I think, critical here is that they responded to the complaint in their motion to dismiss arguments with precisely these issues. So it was obvious to everyone and known by them that this was included in there.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
There's no prohibition against inconsistent defenses. Defendant can raise inconsistent defenses, may they not?
Yes.
Okay. Now, is the allegation that trial counsel in the federal case knew how the victim was going to testify? In other words, that he, that your client had not struck him?
The only evidence that I'm aware of is that my client was claiming that was the case, but no one had ever interviewed the witness.
Your client claimed to counsel that the victim would testify that way.
My client said the victim would testify that way, yes.
Okay. But counsel did not interview him.
Correct.
Now, if counsel interviewed him, then they might well have wanted to withdraw from the joint agreement, defense agreement.
Correct.
But they didn't do that.
Correct.
And so your complaint stopped short of alleging the failure to get out of the agreement because they didn't even take the first step, which is to interview the victim.
I think that's accurate.
Nick, my last question is, I'm just really surprised that there was a criminal prosecution in the federal court and the victim did not testify.
It's astonishing. It's absolutely astonishing. I see I have about 4 minutes left, if I may reserve the remainder.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, again, my name is Andrew McCletchy, and my partner, Timothy Schimberg, and I represent Boston Stanton, his law firm. Our colleague, Matt Miller, represents the estate of Mr. Covino, who is unfortunately no longer with us. I think that this case presents what I'll call the three Ds: discretion, delay, and death. And this is a case
Could you all hold on for a minute, counsel? The clock doesn't seem to be working. Okay, it's not working here. So, counsel, if it works for you, I will notify you when you have 5 minutes left. And if you want further notifications, please ask me.
I'm just fine, Your Honor. I'll sit down when you tell me to.
All right. Well, I will tell you when you're done. Thank you, counsel. Please proceed.
This is a case where the standard of review should dictate the result. And the reason I say that is there's no dispute in the briefs that the standard of review governing a motion to amend the complaint is an abuse of discretion review. There's no dispute about that.
Is the amendment necessary?
The amendment is absolutely necessary. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is if you look at the initial complaint that's in the record right at the beginning in one, it's a rifle shot. Now, we're used to seeing some of these kind of scattergun complaints, throw everything at the wall and let's see what sticks kind of complaints. But there's absolutely no way to construe this first complaint as anything other than one claim of legal malpractice related to the failure to call Mr. Castillo as a witness at trial. And left with that complaint as the operative complaint, this case is Rance. This case is on all fours with Rance. Because what Rance said is, in the context of a Rule 35C ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that the issue of causation is the same as the prejudice elements in a 35C motion. We had the exact same thing happen here in the 10th Circuit. Judge Daniel found that there was no prejudice and no probability of a different result at trial if Castillo would have been called at trial. And I want to follow up on a question you asked, Judge Roy. Castillo's testimony, it's not at all clear what his testimony might have been. He has two different versions of testimony under oath and affidavits.
Isn't that even a more compelling reason for him to testify at trial before the jury?
I think it's a less compelling reason because the one thing he was consistent about, and as the 10th Circuit put it, that their quote was, quote, in the vernacular, his testimony was all over the map. But here's one thing he absolutely did confirm, that he was beaten in his cell by the guards that removed him from his cell. And Mr. Schultz authored a memo documenting this incident in which he confirmed that he was a member of the extraction team. Putting Castillo on would have only established one thing, that he was beaten. And that would not have helped the cause. And more importantly, even if Castillo was going to testify that Mr. Schultz didn't participate in the beating, and this is why the claim really misses the boat, this was a conspiracy charge. And this was a charge of aiding and abetting deprivation of a prisoner's rights. He didn't need to participate in that beating to be convicted. And all of the other evidence presented at trial, to include testimony from two other guards, was that Mr. Schultz did in fact participate in the plan to abuse Schultz, and that he gave assistance in furtherance of that plan. Calling Schultz at trial would have only established that. It was far better, excuse me, calling Castillo at trial, and it would not have resulted in acquittal. It would have only hurt the defense.
Did the Tenth Circuit make that finding? I mean, this is that's a nice argument that you could make, but did the Tenth Circuit make that conclusion, that you could use that for purpose of preclusive?
No, the Tenth Circuit certainly did not address issue preclusion.
See, that's a nice argument, but we're kind of limited, aren't we, here? Because all that the trial court found was the Tenth Circuit's, let's just say the federal court's decisions, have preclusive effect. That's really all he found here. He didn't go beyond that and say it would. He didn't go beyond that and say causation fails to be established here because of the reasons you just suggested. Did he?
He did not.
Okay.
He could have, and that would be an independent basis to affirm the summary judgment motion. And if the trial court gets it right, albeit for the wrong reason, this court can certainly affirm on that basis. But the trial court, quite correctly, was dealing with the world as it exists in the operative complaint. And on that front,
why don't you address then Mr. Kaplan's argument that surely you could read 16 and 17 to include the failure to interview Castillo resulted in the failure to interview Castillo resulted in the failure to withdraw from the joint defense agreement because had they known Castillo would have said they would have, his argument they just made, okay?
Your Honor,
why can't we read the complaint the way he suggested?
Sure. Your Honor, with due respect, I don't see how the complaint could possibly be rationally construed that way. If you look at paragraphs 16 and 17, which is the claim against Mr. Covino, the beginning, paragraph 14, incorporates the previous allegations, the general allegations of the complaint, which make crystal clear that this is about the failure to call Castillo. 17 says, had the witness testified before the jury, the witness we're talking about is clearly Mr. Castillo, plaintiff would not have been convicted of the charges. It's about Castillo. 16, Covino's failure to contact and or interview a material witness. Well, the material witness that they're talking about is clearly, by virtue of the incorporation, Mr. Castillo. And let me make another point, Your Honor. Maybe you're right. Maybe another judge could have agreed with Mr. Kaplan. That's not the test for abuse of discretion. The test is whether, based on the record before Judge Whitney, did he make an appropriate decision based on the record before him. His finding should be given deference. This is an abuse of discretion review.
On the amended complaint, but not on the grant of summary judgment. And I think what we're talking about here is, did he properly grant summary judgment under the theory of claim preclusion or issue preclusion by virtue of the Tenth Circuit's decision? And that depends on what's in this complaint.
It does, and I think Judge Whitney quite correctly concluded, and he made a very important distinction, I think. He said it's really different when you have a complaint where you start the case and you plead very generally, and then you pare it down as you head to trial. He contrasted that with this situation where it is a specific rifle shot complaint. And let's make something clear here too, Your Honor. Throughout the entire course of this litigation, which has already involved a trip all the way up to the Colorado Supreme Court and all the way back down, there's never been any real dispute that this is about the Pedro Castillo issue. The defendants filed a motion to dismiss out of the box that made clear this was about the Pedro Castillo issue. The typical response, if a plaintiff does not agree with that kind of assessment, is to say, no, the defendants are wrong, but even if they're right, give me leave to amend, because there's a whole lot more to this story than that. They didn't do that. The case was then at issue. Disclosures were exchanged. After disclosures were exchanged, no leave to amend was sought. And this is, I think, critical in this case, Your Honor. The deadline to amend the pleadings was in July of 2006, long before the summary judgment motions were fully briefed, long before the order granting summary judgment, and there was ample opportunity to seek leave to amend. In fact, after the motions for summary judgment are filed, which make clear that this is all about the Castillo issue, the Castillo issue is the only issue pled. Based on Rance, we argued that summary judgment was appropriate. The response was never, well, wait a second, there's a whole lot more to this story. Never. And
well, but the decision of whether or not to interview, the decision of whether or not to withdraw from the joint trial agreement, those are related issues, aren't they?
They were never pled, Your Honor. They were never pled. Those issues were never pled. And I think it's important, if you look at the supplemental record that we filed, which is the transcript of the summary judgment hearing and the hearing on the motion to amend that we had in front of Judge Whitney, at page 31, Mr. Kaplan was asked, why didn't you move to amend before you went up appeal, on appeal? At page 31 in the supplemental record, his answer is, number one, I never thought I would lose. I was shocked that I would lose on the estoppel argument, so it never occurred to me before then to file. Under Polk, under Varner, under all of the cases, a court can grant, deny leave to amend, even though it's a liberal standard, if there's a delay. And under those cases, when there is a delay and the motion is untimely, as it is here, after the deadline to amend has passed, the plaintiff has to show good cause about why he didn't move for leave to amend earlier. The answer of that I never thought I would lose is not good cause to seek a late amendment of the complaint. And it's important to keep in mind that these aren't new theories. These are not new theories at all. These are all theories that if Mr. Kaplan didn't know before the complaint was filed, his client certainly did.
Let me ask a question about that. In all the arguments about ineffective assistance of counsel in the federal court, I think twice it was done, well, at least once, did Mr. Schultz's counsel there argue the failure to withdraw from the joint defense agreement was a form of ineffective assistance of counsel?
I don't believe they did, Your Honor. I don't think that issue was ever adjudicated. I think there was some supplemental briefing in federal court, but Judge Daniels certainly never addressed the failure to withdraw.
And I counsel, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Another point on that front that I think is important on the joint defense agreement, it doesn't matter. Before the parties to that criminal proceeding entered into the joint defense agreement, Judge Daniel had already denied a motion filed by my client for a separate trial. Judge Daniel had already entered a detailed order about, after a hearing, what co-conspirator statements were going to be admitted at trial. So regardless of whether there was a joint defense agreement at this trial, the evidence was coming in. There was nothing that could be done to undo that. Withdrawing from the joint defense agreement was not going to get you there. And to pick up on a comment you made earlier, Judge Richman, about the summary judgment standard and based on this complaint, I think based on this complaint, there was only the Castillo issue. Let's assume I'm wrong. Let's assume that Judge Whitney granted the motion to amend. And I don't think he should have, and I certainly don't think he abused his discretion in not doing it. Summary judgment still would have been appropriate, because the case law is clear that you can't overcome summary judgment based on speculation. You have to come forward with facts that show a genuine issue for trial. And if you look at what they came up with below, they don't have facts that would overcome the affirmative showing that we made that we were entitled to summary judgment. First is testimony from one of the other cowboys to the effect that the use of force against Castillo was justified. That doesn't matter. First, use of force establishes force was used. More importantly, it has absolutely no bearing on the substantive elements of the crimes that these people were charged with: conspiracy and aiding and abetting. Second is testimony from Mr. Mendez, the cellmate of Mr. Castillo. They didn't offer an affidavit from Mr. Mendez. What they offered was an affidavit from another one of the cowboys that said, if you called Mendez, here's what he would say. That's hearsay. You can't use hearsay to overcome summary judgment. And the final group of allegations, and there's been absolutely no affidavits, there's been nothing filed below that says that failing to withdraw from the joint defense agreement somehow caused injury. They need to do that by affidavit. They haven't done it. But just think about the theory. It doesn't make sense. Regardless of whether there's a joint defense agreement, all of this evidence was coming in at trial anyway. It didn't harm anybody.
Was there a certificate of review with this complaint? There must have been a certificate of review.
There was a certificate of review, but that's of no value in overcoming summary judgment, Your Honor. That's, you know, just the initial showing that they've conferred with somebody to say that the claims don't lack substantial justification.
No, but I'm getting at, did the certificate of review say anything about failure to withdraw from the joint defense agreement in connection with the original complaint?
No. The certificate of review simply said, as they typically do, I've conferred with a licensed professional and they've said that the claims in the complaint don't lack substantial justification. And I think it's really important to think about this theory that they're offering from a more big picture standpoint. This was a 10-week jury trial in federal court. 65 witnesses were called. There was over 8 weeks of testimony. The jury deliberated for 3 days. And numerous witnesses came forward and testified that these people conspired to beat Castillo. They beat Castillo and they committed overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. To suggest that this testimony that's all over the map would have changed the result, or withdrawn from a joint defense agreement would have changed the result, that's just pure speculation. But more importantly, I don't think you need to get to any of that, because the question that's really before you today is, was the decision below to deny leave to amend an abuse of discretion? And it wasn't. Look at the delay in the record. If they wanted to amend, they needed to do that before July of 2006. They had 13 months before July of 2006 to amend the complaint if they wanted to. And there's not a single one of these theories that's offered in this amended complaint that couldn't have been amended back in 2005 or 2006. And in all of the proceedings below, you've never heard any good justification for why there was a delay in seeking this amendment. You've never heard any explanation whatsoever in the
parties' counsel.
Am I out of time, Your Honor?
Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your patience with us. We appreciate it. We're sorry about the clock problem. Mr. Kaplan, as I recall, you've got about 4 minutes and 10 seconds. And do you want any notification shy of that time, or should I just let you know when your time's up?
If you can give me a minute, I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. The briefs, I think, cover the issue of delay, but I'd like to very briefly go through that. You'll see on page 15 of my amended opening brief, the dates start there. February 8th of 2006 is when the motion to dismiss was denied originally. So February 8th of 2006. Our initial disclosures were filed April 21st. They filed the first summary judgment motion June 8th. So we have from April 21st, when we finished our disclosures, until June 8th when they filed the first motion for summary judgment to theoretically amend our complaint. I would suggest to this court that that is not an unreasonable delay. Then the case went up on appeal to this court, to the Supreme Court, back down. We got the mandate from this court in February 22nd of 2010. Mr. Covino died April 1st of 2010. So is that an unreasonable delay?
Well, you didn't amend the complaint until August of 2010, or maybe even October, about 8 months after the Supreme Court mandate came out.
That's
and
correct.
During that time, Covino did pass away. Was it known that Covino was ill, by the way, when the mandate came down? I suspect it may have been.
I knew Mr. Covino was in a wheelchair. I had no idea why. I still to this day don't know why he died. I don't know if they're related. But we had 37 days from the time that we got the mandate back from this court and the time he died. And they're claiming there's prejudice because of his death, not because I waited until September. And then what's really important, and it's in the record but not in any of the briefs, is the fact that I had to file two motions for enlargement of time during the summer of 2010 because I needed to substitute someone for Mr. Covino since he was dead. There was the notice of death was filed, or suggestion of death wasn't filed until April 22nd, I believe, of 2010, so much later. And then I had to figure out who was going to be the personal representative. There was no personal representative that was named for this estate. So I filed two motions for enlargement of time to substitute the personal representative. And if I chose that Mrs. Covino, and then somebody else was appointed a personal representative, as I said in my motion to the trial court, I've got the wrong party, my case will be dismissed. So I had to wait for them to designate a personal representative, which finally got done in August, and then they filed their second motion for summary judgment. The judge actually granted the substitution after the motion for summary judgment was filed.
What are the implications, if any, that the trial court didn't have jurisdiction over the case during the entire period it was in the appellate courts?
You know, I don't think trial court had jurisdiction. I tried to have it remanded back down. You know, when it was in front of the court. Yeah,
I understand that. But the complaint seems to be on the timeliness that you didn't file it while the matter was on appeal.
Right. 1 minute, sir.
Yes, and that's precisely why I shouldn't be blamed. They are the ones who caused the summary judgment to occur. They're the ones who asked for certiorari in the Supreme Court. I don't understand how I or my client can be penalized when we didn't have the availability to get back to the trial court because it didn't have that jurisdiction.
Counsel, I have one other question.
Yes, sir.
The allegations about Mr. Mendez, the allegations about Guard Freeman, the allegations about the joint defense agreement, all those facts were known to Mr. Schultz, certainly by the time he was convicted in whenever it was 2003, right? He knew that those witnesses weren't called, and he knew that they didn't withdraw from the joint defense agreement, right? They were all known to him.
I think that's a reasonable presumption, yes.
They could have been alleged in the complaint, the original complaint that was filed in 2005. There's nothing that prevented that.
I can't say otherwise to that. And in fact, that's why it was litigated in that first motion to dismiss.
Counsel, your time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor, very much.
Thank you for your oral arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.